The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined today by our special guest, Daniel Sichel, who is European Performance Lead at Mindshare. Hello to you, Daniel.
Hello, nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Lovely to have you on. And joining us from the opposing wing of the ExchangeWire Towers is Rachel Smith, our COO. How are you, Rachel?
Very well, thank you, Matt. So far away in the opposing wing of the
ExchangeWire Towers, Daniel. It's many moons away.
Yeah, definitely socially distanced. I want to emphasize that.
Absolutely. Diving into our first news story of the week, location data could be key for brands in a post-COVID landscape, according to an article published in Ad Age. With most consumers eager to get back into the outside world and ditch the device-heavy pandemic lifestyle, the fountain of first-party data generated by lockdowns is at risk of drying up, making location data potentially vital. Amid the pandemic, essential retailers have been able to use mobility information to ascertain whether consumers are willing to shop in store or whether they prefer online only and tailor their campaigns accordingly. Location data can also refine and filter first-party data collected during lockdown by defining distinct households, making up for the ambiguity created by other identifiers, for example, email addresses, of which consumers usually have multiple. So my first question to you guys is, what are the benefits of using location data and how useful can location data have been and continue to be under lockdown measures? Rachel, let's start off with you.
So Daniel very helpfully just provided a spoiler for both of us prior to pressing record, which is that he's a location data expert. So I'm going to leave the expert opinions to him and give you my anecdotal opinions. Obviously, location data is, you know, providing a very important basis on which brands and marketers can be using to target customers. And I can see that it's only going to become more important in a world where other tools may be less available. But the first thing that I thought when reading this story was, what about the data privacy implications of the way that location data is currently used and perhaps the way that brands and marketers might have plans to use it in the future? And more specifically, I started to think about opt-in rates. You know, we have this conversation quite a lot on the podcast and in various ExchangeWire formats, including in the office, that my personal opinion, and I know some of my colleagues share it as well, is that the general public are becoming more and more data conscious and data aware. Now, we might still be quite far away from people really caring a lot about the permissions that they provide potential advertisers and data gatherers with. But my feeling is that they're going to become more and more tuned into that. So in terms of, to answer your question, I suppose, Matt, in terms of levels of importance, I think it's going to become increasingly important, as set out in that article, for some very obvious reasons. I can see perhaps some particular channels in which it will become increasingly useful. So the retail media space, where retailers are really looking to target customers and consumers in new ways because they're wanting to obviously find people in an in-person environment. And so I think that there's a lot of opportunities for digital out of home, being able to use location data as long as it's used responsibly and in a privacy compliant way. But then on the other hand, I really wonder about that. So I'm actually really interested to hear what you've got to say, Daniel, but because I feel like I want to be more convinced that technology suppliers and vendors that have got location data tools and technology are really have privacy compliance and data governance at the forefront of the ways in which they're delivering those tools and applying those tools.
Yeah, I mean, you've made some excellent points there. Trying to remember them all, but going on the most recent one. So digital out of home, I completely agree. I think, you know, we've spoken for years about multi-touch point and ensuring we have campaigns that are able to engage audiences in multiple environments. So being able to have consistent approaches between those environments is really key. Digital out of home is an excellent way of tying up location data and targeting with something quite high impact as people are moving down the street. So, and that's something, it's something technology is improving. You know, it's been available for quite a while, digital out of home, programmatic digital out of home. That's probably been the last couple of years. I've been hearing more and more about it. More and more partners we work with are offering it. But as the technology improves, that's just getting better. So, you know, you're seeing more digital out of home screens up and about, and then your ability to target audiences based on proximity is also improving. And tying that back to what you were mentioning in terms of consent. So obviously that's a hot topic now. You know, we're still seeing clients trying to work out how they should be asking for consent, like what the appropriate language is. You know, the drop-off rates are large. There's so many different areas that people can drop off. I think really interestingly, my prediction there is that ultimately it's going to improve the quality of what we see. And the more explicit consent that people are being asked for, the more they'll understand why they're giving consent. So it'll have a few impacts on the location data and programmatic out of home. It will improve the quality of the data we see first party, because people understand why they're being asked for consent and they're happy for that consent to be given. Maybe some of the apps that previously were passing consent or previously passing location data that you consumers don't feel are relevant to them anymore, to have that location data passed externally, will no longer be passing that data. And that's maybe where you'll see some of the poorer quality location data drop off. What is really interesting to know about location data is that it's quite a large portion of it is modeled data. So there'll be, you know, first party data of these people have specifically said, I'm happy to pass that location. And then most partners then model out that that group of data into a wider audience to make assumptions on, you know, who these people actually are. So, and that's okay, and that's absolutely fine. The only issue with model data is when the quality of the initial data isn't very good. So if actually if what we see here is quite a large improvement in that quality of data sources and the quality of first party data that is being modeled, then ultimately location campaigns will improve. It is really interesting. Like it does maybe concern me that the amount of drop off we'll see in first party data, and maybe the impact that will have on lots of the campaigns we're running. But I think it's really up to the partners we work with to ensure that how they introduce those probabilistic models on that data they're receiving, and to ensure that it's continuously high quality is really important.
And I mean, you raise quite an interesting point there as well, Daniel, that when you were speaking specifically about location data, it's not just about the sort of volumes of data available, but also the quality of it, right? So actually totally useless if it's poor quality. And you could sort of argue to a certain extent that the same is true for first-party data. We just make an assumption that all first-party data is rich and important and usable and, you know, actionable. And I guess actually there's probably a quality issue there as well. But also there's probably a question to be asked about the volumes of data and how much of it is actually needed. Okay. So, you know, because your comments, you know, link directly to the article, which was making a good point that during lockdown, volumes of first-party data increased because we were spending so much more time on devices and at home and in front of screens. And the fear, obviously, from brands and marketers is that that's going to decrease now that we're actually all outside walking around doing things and leaving our phones to one side. But maybe that won't be as much of an issue as we imagine it's going to be. Maybe actually the bigger issue, which has always been there, is about the quality of data and the ways in which you can use it and, you know, action it.
100%. So my background actually before I moved into my current role was affiliate marketing. So I've been working with email data for a very, very long time, which is a great source of quality first-party data. And you are absolutely correct. You know, just having someone's email isn't enough. It's the quality of that email address. Did you receive any additional preference information, profiling information on top of that email to enrich your understanding of that audience? So then when we look at device IDs, you know, what else do we have about that device ID? You know, do we have the fact, do we know that they were on Wi-Fi when you received it? So they're likely to be at home. Okay, so that's interesting to know. We're consistently seeing this person spend more time at home. Those are going to be the best environments to engage them in. And actually, what's interesting when we start to layer in location data with how we target people, it's where do we want to target them? What environments do we want to target them in? The reality is, when people are at home, they're in more digital environments, you can actually target them in.
Someone just turned the lights off where you are.
I think they just automatically, I'm going to wave my hands about, but I'll switch it on in a sec.
It's fine. We can still see you, and the listeners good. Don't need to see you. They can still hear your dulcet tones.
Yeah, so it's just basically sat in the dark. Yeah. the amount of environments you're in at home, like being at home is actually perfect for location targeting because it means we can overlay the fact that we've got someone's device ID with the fact that we can then device ID match that to inventory, wider inventory, because someone's at home, they're in multiple digital environments. You know, you mentioned the when someone's walking down the street, well, the reality is when someone's walking down the street, there's quite a limited amount of digital environments you can engage them in. So the strategies that personally I tend to employ, and this, you know, maybe goes back to the original question, which is, what does this mean for the future? Is I do see a sort of shift away from maybe trying to influence people in situations. So because there may be some challenges with being able to match a device ID as people are walking down the street with, you know, what digital environment they may be in. Like, you know, I'll give you some examples. A bus timetable apps, that's a example of an app that has previously been passing location data. And it's also an example of an app that someone may be in where a location partner may decide to serve an ad. Weather apps, another very good example. These are all sort of apps that someone may be in at the point where they're outside walking down the street. That's really key. It's really important to know. But those are limited environments. Someone may be on social platforms, on Facebook, but unlikely when they're walking down the street. So it's really about understanding that how much value is there trying to advertise to someone in situ versus I know you frequently visit my store. I know you frequently visit this high street because I've got that device ID that tells me that. Why don't I just run a campaign when you're at home, when I know you're in a much broader environments we can engage you in? You can be on Facebook, you can be on in mobile web environments, you can be in much wider app environments when you're at home. And that's where it begins to get more exciting. That's when you can start to influence, not necessarily in the situation, but just have that longer term influence. I know you frequently visit this place. I'll serve an ad to you in the evening. And hopefully the next day when you're walking past that store, you remember that ad and you'll be able to go in and do something. And then the other really good thing is point of sale. So, we mentioned digital out of home. We talked about those multiple touch points. That point of sale advertising that most brands we work with run is an additional touch point. Although we don't control, we have to realize it does have an impact. If I've served you an ad in the evening and the next day you see point of sale advertising, I'm much more likely to engage with it. You're much more likely to convert because it's no longer the first touch point you've had with that offer.
Mm. I mean, that's sorry, Matt.
Carry on.
Daniel's raising some really interesting points. The idea of reaching people in a wider environment, I think, is going to become more important in the future because there will be challenges around accessing device ID data, right? You know, there's been announcements this week about what Apple is doing to permissions around device ID data in an iOS environment. Lots of predictions about Google perhaps following, you know, wandering down the same path with their Android device IDs. So, you know, regardless of what is or is not happening there at the moment, we have to assume that being able to get specific identifiers might become or very much probably will become more and more challenging. So actually, we need to be thinking about this from a wider perspective as well, not just where we can actually get device identity or location data, but also what is the best environment in which to reach people. And I'm starting to think that that broader environment is going to be more useful for brands and advertisers in the longer term.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Kind of feed in on both your points. Do you see location data becoming more sort of intent based rather than just this is where this consumer is, and therefore, in terms of say the lockdowns, rather than people being kind of tied to this is when they're commuting, they're obviously going to be walking past a particular shop, a particular train station at this point. Whereas now, where we're still kind of in these half in, half out lockdown environments, it'd be right. This consumer actually wants to go to these shops.
Completely. That absolutely is where I see things going. Because of the limitations you've mentioned on the amount of first-party data coming through, because of the limited environments people are going to be in when they are out and about, building a picture, painting a picture of what your audience is doing and tailoring campaigns around that picture, that understanding is so important. You know, we so frequently see briefs that tell us this is who your audience is, and actually I think that many many partners do this, but they then, rather than just accepting that this is who the audience is based on the brief we've received from clients, it's, let's see what we can tell about our audience. Let's see what partners know about our audience. So let's brief out partners to say, right, I need you to look back. So most location partners, I believe, can look back potentially 60 to 90 days in terms of how long they can hold that device ID. Some can do it for longer. There was some specifics around consent I'm not 100% over, but you can ask someone today to look back over the last X amount of days to see what has audiences been doing. So here are all of the stores we have. Here are all the GPS locations, postcodes of these stores. Tell us who's frequently visiting them, like how frequently are they visiting them, like how big is that data set that you have, and they can do that retrospectively, and that makes it really interesting because then they can come back to us with that insight piece on intent. Right, we can then say, right, you know, these device IDs are doing this, what else are they doing, like where else are they visiting, like tell us more about their profile. And often that's not information you get in the brief from clients, so being able to work with location partners to get that insight for me is invaluable.
Awesome, positive stuff for location data going forward then. Moving forward into the second story, lockdown measures imposed to fight the spread of COVID-19 have caused social media platforms to become major retail spaces in the UK. According to research from Bazaar Voices Influencer, 79% of consumers are now more likely to shop on a social platform compared to last year. Shopping on TikTok grew the most over the period, rising by a staggering 553%, followed by Pinterest, Instagram and Facebook, which all recorded triple figure percentage increases. And the number of consumers who claim to always shop using their smartphone more than tripled, while the number who always shop via social media more than doubled. On top of facilitating sales, social media has also become integral to discovering new brands, with 70% of respondents indicating that they had tried out a new brand after seeing it promoted on a social media platform. Relevance was the most important factor for consumers when buying from a new brand through social media, followed by the benefits that product offers, visual brand content, and the price. So my first content question here, after sort of your initial thoughts on this one, are any of the findings here surprising to you? And do you think social media platforms will continue to be sort of these major retail spaces they are becoming once restrictions are lifted completely? Daniel, let's start off with you.
So no, it doesn't surprise me at all. And the reason it doesn't surprise me is because obviously we've seen this trend for years with these with social platforms. You know, as they evolve, as they mature, as their audiences mature, people just become more and more comfortable making that purchase decision within that environment. And that's the most important point for me, is, again, going back to my affiliate background, I learned very early like how important affiliate environments are, environments that are actually converting users. It's not just about pointing someone somewhere, getting them to click and moving them into an external environment, but the ability for certain environments to convert users, comparison websites, aggregators, cashback websites, voucher sites, etc. And now what you've got here is social platforms, you know, the formats that they offer, how innovative some of them are, how engaging some of them are, you know, you've got expandable formats, you've got Facebook offering 360 views of cars, you've got you know, carousel formats where you can start to scroll through multiple different retail items. You've got so many different ways that users can essentially convert themselves in that environment, and they do such a good job of that. You know, the amount of investment that's going into video content, which you know, all that is doing is keeping someone's attention for a specific amount of time in that environment, looking at that unit as they get converted. So no, absolutely, I'm not surprised at this at all. And I think it will continue because consumers, they don't like to click. It's an unnatural behavior. So actually they sort of prefer to be told something and convinced about something in an environment they're comfortable in.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't find any of these findings surprising either. I suppose I come at it from a slightly different angle. Again, you know, much more of the outsider as opposed to the sort of expert insider point of view, Daniel. I thought that the sort of percentage increases were quite interesting. They were mammoth, obviously, but I'm feeling like that's starting from a fairly low base, even though obviously shopping via social media platforms has been going on for a while. It still probably represented a really small proportion of actual overall purchases. So no surprise there to see it kind of explode during during the pandemic, or from the start of the pandemic onwards, and then to really gain sort of popularity over that period. I thought some stuff about the way that they kind of characterise the demographics of the respondents was quite interesting. This is a bit of an outside point of view, so bear with me here. But they were talking about the breakdown of the sort of nearly 4,000 odd respondents that they had in this particular study, majority of which, there was a bit of an error in the wording, I think 71% of which were millennials, and then a smaller proportion Gen Zs, a smaller proportion again, about 10% Gen X, and about 1% baby boomers. And I was just then thinking about the demographics of the general population in terms of purchasing power. And actually, baby boomers are still the biggest proportion of the UK population, followed by millennials, and then followed by Gen X. So, I mean, obviously, younger people are probably going to be more attracted to purchasing on social media platforms because it will feel a bit more natural, etc. But it did make me think, I still think, it might sound ridiculous, but I still think there's a massive opportunity for social media platforms to think about ways to get those larger chunks of the population and get them purchasing in that kind of environment. So targeting baby boomers, it sounds ridiculous, but we know it's not, right? Because we also know that hyper-casual gaming has just exploded in terms of popularity amongst older generations. You know, it's not just kids using these tools and these platforms anymore. So why, you know, marketed in the right way, I could see TikTok becoming just as popular with baby boomers in theory as it is with younger generation. And it just made me think that there's a wealth of opportunity out there for social media platforms. Do I think that purchasing on those platforms is going to continue to grow? Definitely, just because the proliferation of use on those platforms will continue to grow. But I do think there's going to be some jockeying for position amongst the big platforms mentioned in the report. So, you know, TikTok, Instagram, Pinterest, Facebook, because I think the popularity of those platforms is going to ebb and flow in tandem with things like consumer control of data and privacy and people's awareness of that various other sort of political and government related issues that are rolling around in the background. I think these things are going to start to go hand in hand, and we're going to start to see a bit of a read across from those sort of social issues onto use of social media platforms and who's prepared to shop on those platforms as a result.
Definitely. I think on your point in terms of targeting the particular demographics, I think, like you say, there is a huge opportunity for targeting those wider groups. Just look at, for example, Etsy's recent acquisition of Depop for something like $1.6 billion. I think the revenue multiple is something like 23x, and it shows how much growth they're seeing in that small segment. So imagine the scale of growth that you could get for targeting, like say, the baby boomers, you know, the millennials. There is so much opportunity there.
Totally.
Carry on.
No, sorry, Matt, I interrupted. You go.
My question sort of based off that is, how do you think social media platforms are going to capitalize on that opportunity, and where do you think sort of the more traditional commerce sites are going to try and, you know, work their way into having more sort of social features to sort of capitalize on the way back as such?
I mean, that is a big, big question. I think the challenge that has been noted, that is without question a challenge, is, you know, where does this money sit? Where's the most disposable income? And it's actually not in the younger generations. It's in the generation not up from there, right? Not just young adults, but slightly older, 25 to 35, 25 to 45 range. That's where you see the most disposable income. And how do we get that age range to adopt more purchase behavior in those social platforms? I think better integrations with social platforms of product listings, mm-hmm. being able to have full product feeds in social environments is really, really important. One of the, I think, limitations that social platforms has is that they can only advertise a very small amount when you're only putting a banner there or putting a video there. But, you know, we are seeing Facebook, for example, integrate better with platforms like Shopify to enable stores to have that sort of social presence and displaying more products, allowing users to actually physically purchase within the platform. And that's a key thing is, you know, if you accept that actually your website's becoming less and less important to bring users in, and actually better integration with some of these platforms to allow audiences to purchase where they're comfortable, to be made aware of your products, to consider your products, and to be converted against your products in those environments, that's what probably needs to happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that speaks to Matt's question around, you know, what would either traditional retailers or even just retailers that have got really strong e-commerce plays, how do they get a piece of this action? I completely agree. I think it's via better integrations with social platforms and via looking for customers rather than on their own websites or on their own platforms, looking for customers where they are. Again, it's that widening out the sort of view of where and how, where you find your customers and how you acquire them, how you target them and how you speak to them. And I think that's the thing that social media platforms have really taught us during the pandemic, is that they're it's not just about social interactions, right? It's about it's possible for them to be very transactional. We talk quite a lot, don't we, at Exchange by Matt, about the sort of super utility apps of Southeast Asia and China. And, you know, I think there is a massive opportunity for some of the more westernized social media platforms to be thinking, and even other players, incumbents, people that are just developing their platforms now that we maybe don't even know about. There's a real opportunity for them to provide that utility transactional space. And if they get that right, and if they start to be able to convince either legacy retailers or other e-commerce platforms that there's real value in integrating with them, then I think that's a huge opportunity.
Absolutely. Awesome.
How do you both think, like, what is going to be the trick? So, you know, none of us here are of the youngest age group that maybe we're talking about that we're seeing the highest adoption of social platforms. You know, we mentioned TikTok, you mentioned that 70%, like, is better integration, is that it? So I would say that, you know, I'm still quite comfortable going onto sites. I'm not wholly convinced and converted in social environments yet. I still like to be able to navigate through to the site. I actually feel there's almost some advocacy that you get from seeing a website is real, seeing a business is real and being directed to them. I don't just trust the adverts I see in social environments. And that's what convinces me, actually, when I take that journey myself externally. I sort of need that to push me through the door. Like, better integration is one thing, but still there may be just a slight mistrust. You know, there may be that element of research. And, you know, we're talking here maybe about smaller value purchases, but for me, where it gets really interesting is some of the higher value purchases that we may start seeing being communicated in social platforms. So what do we think is going to have that influence on some of the older demographics to be better converted in social environments?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I would characterize my social media shopping experience in pretty much the exact same way that you've described yours, which is that where I've made purchases, in fact, off the top of my head, I'm going to say they're quite minimal, if at all, maybe one or two purchases. It's either been with a brand that I've already known very well and therefore trusted, or I've wanted to, car alarm going off in the background. Let me just shut the window and see if that makes any difference. Worth noting that the Exchange Wire office is on Hatton Garden, the jewellery quarter, so maybe there's some kind of jewellery heist going on in the background. So what I was saying is more trusted brands. If I'm not being shown ads from brands that I know, or if I'm, you know, wanting to discover more about them, I absolutely feel like I've got to go onto their website to do a bit more research. So the other thing could be thinking about better mechanisms to furnish customers with the relevant information to give them that confidence. If you're a new brand, if you're a DTC, if you're also selling maybe smaller, lower value products and you're looking for volume, just something about either the creatives that you're using or the ways in which you're marketing yourselves and expressing information about your company need to come back to branded principles, I think, to give people confidence to shop with you. And then if we think about legacy retailers, I think it's just more, I'd like to see more of those legacy retailers appearing on social media platforms, because that would give me the confidence not just in purchasing from those retailers, but also in purchasing from others. It'll have a bit of a trickle-down effect, right? Rightly or wrongly, that's kind of how it works, especially I think for an older generation. You know, I am proudly Generation X. And so I'm quite happy to pick up new pieces of technology and try new things, but I do need to be convinced of the value of them. I'm not a big user of social media platforms, but that doesn't make me uninterested in doing things on social media platforms. For me, it's got to be about added value and convenience. So I would say more brand presence and more convincing brand presence in that social media environment. Basically, you want it to feel less like social media advertising. It's kind of got a slightly bad reputation, certainly on westernized social media platforms. I mean, again, maybe we can be looking to our Chinese friends and our Southeast Asian counterparts to see how they do it differently there.
Absolutely. Moving into the third story of the week, ad spend is beginning to recover in Australia, led by a 47.1% rise in digital and a 44.2% growth in TV. These stats were measured in April, and these increases contributed to an overall ad spend of $584.4 million, nearly 40% more than April last year, according to figures calculated by SMI. According to SMI's Jane Ratcliffe, the results have sent the market into uncharted territory. This is a positive development. The results mean that the lead times for ad spots will be even tighter, with inventory stretched far more prior to the pandemic. Moreover, the continued volatility caused by the emergence of new COVID variants and subsequent government restrictions are making it more difficult for marketers to commit to budget for the long term. Interestingly, the analysis found that TV is the only format yet to have emerged from 2020 in a better position, up 13% in the year to date. This rise is expected to continue, led predominantly by the popularity of video on demand, making TV one of the primary forces in ad spend recovery in the country alongside digital. Radio and out of home also saw recovery, and travel, hospitality and leisure brands are expected to up their ad spend soon. My first question is how the results compare here to others that have been springing up across EMEA and the US and in other APAC markets. And how does Australia compare to these other markets? Rachel, let's start with you.
So my homeland, my beloved homeland that I haven't been able to visit for the last 18 months that I've been shut out of, I feel like Australia, the advertising market in Australia is probably leading the field and gives us a little bit of hope as to what a recovery might look like elsewhere. So it's no surprise to see a bounce back, I think, at this time of the year. And I think it's an indication that we will potentially be enjoying a similar sort of bounce back in European markets and US markets if it hasn't already got underway. I think it's the detail of the way things have sprung back to life in Australia that make it particularly interesting for two reasons. One is obviously it's a different market. Every market's got its own individual characteristics as an advertising market, but also too because they've had a completely different pandemic experience, certainly to us here in the UK and the rest of Europe and also to the US. So the things that I think were interesting about that report is the TV element. I think that increase in consumption of video on demand is interesting because that would have been coming from quite a low base in Australia. It's been a market that has been very slow to adopt video on demand for various reasons. Got to do with the way that content is available across the broadcaster, the main broadcasted channels in Australia, and the ways in which people are accessing content, and even basic things like Wi-Fi infrastructure. So it's no surprise that things are now really accelerating, and we're just going to see that really boom, I think. So 2021 is going to be a very exciting year for anything TV related and video related in Australia. The other thing that I thought was quite interesting is that the sectors that were enjoying very stable advertising spend from here onwards were things like government, insurance, and what was the other one? One other big sort of infrastructure, the banking industry. Australia's coming into an election year, so the government will be pouring a lot of money into advertising over the next 12 months. I mean, political advertising is very different in Australia than, for example, the US. It's much more like it is here in the UK. But nevertheless, the point is that the government will be pouring a lot of advertising into promoting their public health campaigns. They're very proud of the way that they have more or less handled things with respect to the pandemic. So they're really going to be wanting to push messages out there about how competent they are. So I think that's having a particular impact on the market, and I'm not sure if we'll see the same things here. And I suppose suppose, you know, insurance and banking, I think, in Australia are reflective in general of a strong economic standpoint. I mean, I think the economy in Australia was doing quite well before the pandemic anyway. It's had a setback like every global economy has, but it will be moving very strongly from here onwards. And I think that is definitely going to be mirrored in, certainly in the UK and the US. I think the economic outlook will be significantly more cheerful from here onwards because the economy is in a growth position. The pace at which it grows and the pace at which that those economic factors strengthen, I think might be a bit slower here in Europe than it is in Australia, but I think we will start to see some really similar trends. And again, in terms of advertising, you know, connected TV, digital out of home, I think are going to be the big winners in terms of advertising spend over the next 12 months or so.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's such, yeah. I mean, so we spoke about this just before we joined here, and one of the, as you've been talking, it's made me realize the biggest thing that I think will change is there's just been a reset in how familiar, in the channels that we're comfortable on. There's been a complete reset in, as consumers, which channels are we comfortable engaging with media on, what channels are we used to engaging with media on as well, like how important are those channels to our journey. And that reset's happened at a consumer level. It's happened at a brand level as well. Brands are resetting, right? So with all the advertising money they've clawed back over the last year or so, it's allowed them to rethink, right? So we're no longer seeing plans being put together just because this is what we've been doing year on year. It makes sense for us. We're comfortable signing this off. It's easy for us to sign this off. Let's just continue doing that. It makes sense. It's always worked. Now brands have sort of sat back and been like, okay, well, actually now everything's changed. Consumers, the way consumers are engaging and navigating around these channels are changing as well. Let's really look at what's important to us. So how do I think that will continue changing? I think we are definitely going to see that shift, more of that shift into digital. We will see more measures against all forms of advertising, much more onus on measurement in general. So how much insight can we get from when we are running other non-digital pieces, offline pieces? Well, you know, we talk about programmatic digital out of home or digital out of home itself because it's measurable, it's accountable. We haven't had that before if you just put up a poster in the middle of a street somewhere. So where can we make advertising a bit more accountable? What is that ROI against things? And, you know, I've always been a big believer that whether you're running a brand campaign, whether you're running a performance campaign, everything should be accountable in some way. There should be a measure, some uplift you should be looking at, whether it's site traffic, whether it's brand health. You should always be looking to do that to make sure you have an understanding of whether your decision making has been validated and is correct. So like that's what I'm really excited about, like moving forward. That's where I think, you know, coming out of pandemic, like people are going to be a little bit more concerned about which channels they put on plan. They're not just going to spend for the sake of spending. But there's also, even saying that, there's an excitement. We're seeing some brands who are thinking, well, actually, our competitors are not spending yet. If we start spending here, we can have much higher share of voice. If we want to spend on TV and H2 this year, our competitors aren't doing that yet. Maybe we can get a head start. Maybe we can get a higher share of voice. And they couldn't have done that a year ago because there was just ongoing spend across most of these channels. So there is that sort of excitement to get back into it and get a head start against competitors. And that, I think that will make things very interesting.
And also, it's that thing, isn't it, that once you start seeing your competitors spending more, then that releases budgets, right, miraculously. So, there is still a fair bit of volatility involved in the advertising industry at the moment, connected with the way the world is sort of moving through a recovery phase from the pandemic. And there's still many unknowns, certainly in the near term, so the next 6 to 12 months, when none of us are too sure what that's really going to look like in terms of public health, lockdowns, being able to move around, and the impact that might have on our lives. But with enthusiasm and the idea that things are getting restarted somewhere, I think many brands and advertisers will just be inspired to start spending because others are starting to spend and because things are starting to move around. Even, I know, you know, it's not directly related to spending money on advertising, but I was just chatting yesterday with colleagues here in the office that I'm feeling envious of the way that New York City's kind of framing their release from lockdown. You know, they're having a big party in Central Park and they're talking about, you know, the sort of calming down of government restrictions associated with pandemic really means that we're moving into the next phase of recovery and this is something we should celebrate and we can all start spending more time together. And I'm feeling really envious of that. I'm like, yeah, I want to celebrate too. And I sort of feel from a public health point of view, London's probably in a very similar situation as New York is in terms of numbers vaccinated and public health sort of stats. And I kind of feel like we should be celebrating as well. So it's that classic thing of once you see someone else doing it, you want to get on the bandwagon too.
Absolutely. In terms of sort of coming back to the points on measurement and digitization, will sort of the not the TVs experienced a lack of measurement, but do you think that kind of issue surrounding that channel will continue to hold it back as it kind of peaks and then sort of brands and which have become much more comfortable with digital, they start looking elsewhere towards those channels, as you mentioned, Daniel, in terms of the, you know, out of home and audio, where there traditionally hasn't been that, but that's really come to the fore now?
So yeah, you mentioned two channels I do really like that we're seeing some great developments in. I think digital audio has been fantastic. Podcasts, you know, over the last few years has been, including this, has been a great new development. You know, the ability to talk to people, it be in their ears and be in a contextually relevant environment from a digital audio perspective is fantastic. You've got digital at home. In my opinion, I think there is a little bit of a fear still on accountability, on making everything too accountable. Not everything is measurable, right? Not every. If consumers don't click, we mentioned that when we run brand uplift studies, again, you're looking at a small data set. You're not surveying 100% of the people that saw a campaign. So, you know, everything, all measurement needs to be taken with a pinch of salt unless it's fully digital and you can track every single journey. So I think there is absolutely still space for TV because and TV spend because of the length of time that someone's in the environment, people are watching. Connected TV is giving us that opportunity to target people programmatically across it. There's a lot more measurement to ensure that, you know, someone is actually watching at the time the ad is showing. So, you know, we're paying for people to actually watch the ad rather than hoping that someone watched it and paying just for a spot. So yeah, absolutely. There's still a space for it. That the fear of making everything too accountable, the questions that will lead to, and the fact that there aren't always answers, I think we'll keep spending channels that don't have 100% measurement.
And I think measurement is just going to be a really important question in general across all channels over the coming 12 months. And it's an, you know, unsolved problem that we'll be talking about a lot more in the weeks to come, I'm sure.
Absolutely, we will. Moving into the second part of this week's podcast, where we hear more from Daniel about what he's currently working on and also what he's going to be working on. So, Daniel, over to you.
So I work across Mindshare and also Group M with assisting in mobile and digital best practice frameworks. Mobile specifically is an interest area of mine. So I work with across the agency group to make sure that enablement sessions are introduced, so things like SK Ad Network, iOS 14 updates, etc. Best practice in terms of measurement, in terms of campaign setup. So I work and try and assist on any app campaign that the agency group has. Specifically at the moment, the two main clients I work on within the agency are BP and IBM. BP is definitely more mobile focused. They've got a great loyalty app they've introduced, an electric vehicle charging point app. IBM, I sit more of a European performance lead, working, obviously engaging B2B audiences, which is a big interest area of mine. I think B2B is fascinating. But as of August, I'll be moving into a new agency. I've been at Mindshare 7.5 years. As of August, I'll be moving to Zenith at Publicis to be working as a hub lead on the TikTok account, which is super exciting, which made the question on social e-commerce even more relevant and fascinating for me to be able to contribute to. Very, very excited about that. And I look forward to engaging with you both after that move too.
Yep. on a variety of topics. Big leaving do then, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah, big leaving do. We used to get 1 month sabbatical if you'd been here 10 years. I'm sadly going to miss that.
Sad. Yeah.
Oh, it's okay. I've had a good stint over the last 7.5 years. It's been an amazing agency to be a part of. I've had such freedom to sort of grow myself and expand myself professionally, and it's a good time for me to be moving. It'll be very sad, but exciting at the same time.
Mm. To what extent? Just reflecting on your mobile focus with your clients, BP and IBM, to what extent do they feel concerned about some of the changes that are coming forward in an advertising environment in a mobile context?
So it's definitely more relevant for BP. IBM is less of a mobile focus, but for BP, we've seen some huge changes in terms of how they're engaging consumers with regards to requesting that consent, making sure that they're communicating to audiences in the same way, differentiating that consent between just being able to track them and also being able to re-engage them. That's been a really fascinating trend, actually. So many clients we work with, also the agency, we have KFC, we have M&S, all have apps as well. There are a number of other apps throughout the wider group that we work with too. There's been a shift in asking how you ask for that consent. We ask that separately. So can I track you and can I re-engage with you? There are concerns about, are users going to accept it? What's the language we need to use? There was also excitement because it actually means with all these questions, with the shift that Apple the focus that Apple has put on consent in general, we're seeing more and more people, both on agency side and advertiser side, get involved in the conversation, which has actually been really beneficial because we've often found, especially with large companies that have an app, the app's not always the biggest focus. Companies are realizing now that their apps are an amazing way to engage with their audiences directly. It's an amazing way. These apps work as almost an open CRM platform for them to talk to their audiences, to have push notifications with them. The publishers we work with in the middle, the platforms, the MMPs, they essentially work as CDPs and DMPs for us, right? They hold that customer data from an agency perspective. That's amazing. We can start creating custom audiences and create amazing campaigns based on ongoing user behaviors in the app. So the answer is excitement. And I can't say that for anyone. I think there's been a lot of nervousness and what it means and maybe a lack of understanding and very quick learning that our brands have had to go through just to make sure that they're up to date and they're doing things correctly. But I think there's excitement in the sense that they know they'll come out of this better, more informed about some of these really important GDPR issues, more informed about how their customers want to be communicated to, and just more informed about mobile marketing in general, which for me future-proofs their business. Like, I think that for me, apps, you're just seeing that shift into more and more app environments by consumers. That for me is the future. Is we're just going to see more and more time spent in apps, whether that's e-commerce apps, whether that's social apps, leisure, lifestyle apps. I've been really excited about the growth in new app categories, lifestyle categories of apps, food categories, fitness, etc. It means more contextual relevancy. It means more environments that we can advertise to audiences in. So, yeah, you can tell how excited I am, obviously, in my voice. But yeah.
They've got the right person for the job working on this, Daniel.
Yes.
That is really interesting. Do you think that some of this then, so the conversations, plural, that you're perhaps having with your brand clients and also having with various technology partners that you're working with around the best practices and the ways in which to engage in a mobile environment, do you think that is moving the focus from sort of tracking and targeting to one of more consumer-centric and consumer-focused, trying to find ways in which to better communicate with consumers in an environment where they're going to be more receptive to it? Do you think that's happening, or do you think that's not happening yet? That might be, something that will happen a bit further down the line. To what extent do you think that's at the forefront of the mind of some of the clients that you work with?
So I think it's still a little bit of a way to go. I think there's always been a little bit of a gap between CRM teams and marketing teams. How current customers want to be spoken to versus prospecting customers. I think that this will cause that gap to close. I think the understanding now of the importance that's going to happen in contextual relevancy, I think that's going to be important for location data. I think that's going to be important for social e-commerce. I think that's going to be important for all marketing moving forward is contextual relevancy and how you speak to audiences. You mentioned about, I asked that question, what do we think is going to be that shift for different demographics, like what's going to convince different demographics to convert in social e-commerce. You mentioned something that I don't think I picked up on, but copy, right? Just the messaging, the creative that's being used needs to be tailored towards the different demographics. You can't just have the same creative being used to talk about people of different age groups. That will be the shift, right? So more dynamic creative that's optimized towards audiences. And that's actually why social platforms are going to be so important moving forward because of their first party data. It's not dependent on device IDs, but every time you log into your social platform, in so many cases, you know someone's age, you know their demographic, and actually you can speak to them in a way that they want to be spoken to. I think that a tailoring of communication between.
Oh, we've lost Daniel, like right at the last moment as well.
Oh no!
Yes, there we go. You're back.
I don't know what happened there. Thankfully, it only happened at the end of this. But yeah,
exactly. I think you pretty much gotten to the conclusion of your point anyway, hadn't you? Saying that, improved creative and copy is absolutely going to make a big difference, and it's going to help, social platforms sort of leverage a much more of a personal communication with potential customers and existing customers.
Relevancy for me is the biggest buzzword that people need to be taking into 2021, 2022. Just relevancy in all aspects of their marketing, contextual relevancy, creative relevancy, product relevancy. That is key. We've talked about it in terms of personalization. We've talked about that, it's been spoken about in terms of brand uplift and things like that, and measuring relevancy, but it needs to be in everything we're thinking about. When you talk about targeted advertising, people don't like the word targeted advertising. But if you ask them, do you want more relevant advertising? Most people are going to say yes. And I think we just need to shift the conversation away from targeting and make it a better word, less taboo word, relevancy.
Totally makes sense.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to hearing more from you, Daniel, in your new role. We'll definitely have to have you back on the podcast later on down the line.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, that was this week's MedTech Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Our pleasure.
Pleasure to have you on. Rachel, thanks very much for joining us
pleasure
as well.
Pleasure to be here.
My pleasure, Matt.
And that was this week's MedTech Podcast. Thank you all for listening.